Criticizing Darwinian evolution is not popular. There's a kind of a resistance against any criticism of it. Richard Dawkins, who is just up the road here in Oxford, in a book called Devil's Chaplain, he wrote, "No qualified scientist doubts evolution is a fact." In fact, he went on to say that it's absolutely safe to say that if you meet somebody who claims not to believe in evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane, or wicked. But I'd rather not say that. And that's how many people look at the subject of evolution. Basically, if you don't believe it, you're insane, you're stupid, or wicked at the worst. Somebody on the radio recently, on one of the Radio 4 talk shows, he said, "Evolution is true as the sky is blue." And this is the sort of paradigm that we're facing in today's society. However, hundreds, in fact thousands of scientists are now questioning and seeking to unravel Darwinian evolution. On the 1st of October 2001, in the Weekly Standard, 100 scientists paid for and took out a two-page advert called "A Scientific Descent from Darwinism," in which they said, "We're skeptical of claims for the ability of random mutation and natural selection to account for the complexity of life." I'm one of those people who's skeptical of the claim that you can get from a bacterium to Beethoven by chance mutations naturally selected. In fact, I'm more than skeptical. I don't believe it. Charles Darwin was the man who came up with this idea. Others were thinking of it at the time, Wallace and so on, but Darwin was the man who crystallized it and put it in his book, Origin of Species. And if you go to the British Natural History Museum in London, you can go into an exhibit all about evolution and the origin of species and Darwin and so on. First thing you see when you walk in is a statue of Darwin. Behind Darwin is a little sign, and on the sign it says, "The problem Darwin solved." You see, before Darwin, if you didn't believe in God and didn't believe in creation, what would you have said to someone who challenged you and said, "Well, if you don't believe in God, how did it all get here? How did all the animals come to be?" And even if you believed in some kind of evolution, you really had no explanation as to how it took place. And Darwin came up with this idea, which he called natural selection. And Darwin, according to Richard Dawkins in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, Darwin made it possible to become an intellectually fulfilled atheist. In other words, before Darwin, it was tricky being an atheist. But now you've got the facts. You've got all you need to know in natural selection. What is natural selection? Well, simply is the idea that nature selects and preserves useful variations in animals and plants. And those that are best adapted leave the most offspring. And of course, after Darwin, genetic mutation was added into the mix. So we have neo-Darwinism. And together, mutations and natural selection have apparently built everything our eyes can see. Now let's just define evolution. Because when you start criticizing evolution, people get a little bit worried, and a definition is going to help us. Now, by evolution, I do not mean variation within a kind. In other words, if we take zebras and horses and donkeys, it may well possibly be that they all are variations of one original created kind. We could say the same for lions and tigers and leopards, or perhaps even wolves and dingoes and dogs. I'm not worried about variation within a kind or a prototype. What Darwin is saying is something completely different. Darwin is actually saying that every plant, every fungus, every animal, all of life is related directly. So that a bat and a buttercup and a banana and Beethoven are all directly related. If you ate plants today, you ate your relatives. If you ate meat today, you ate a direct relative. Because all of life is one big tree. Starting from an original replicating molecule in a warm pond billions of years ago, we now have this massive tree of life. And we're all on this tree of life somewhere. You're a node, and the other plant is a node, and the animals are another node. We're all nodes on this great tree of life. And sometimes when evolutionists think about creation, they have a caricature of what it is. They look at all the different types of dogs and all the different types of finches and all the different types of fish, and they say, are you trying to tell us that God made every single one of those different types originally in the Garden of Eden? And they have this caricature of the creation model. That what we have now is exactly what we had then. But that's not what I'm saying. That's not what the Bible says. The actual creation model says that God created kinds of animals, and that the variation that we see today is a result of natural selection and environment and so on, acting on the information that was in the genomes of those original created kinds. But somebody says, well, this is very interesting. You sound like you're willing to admit to little changes, but you're not willing to admit to big changes. But all that Darwinism is saying is that if you take small changes and add lots of years to that, then you get the big changes. So really, you haven't got a leg to stand on. Well, let's just examine this in greater detail. If I was giving you a spelling test tonight, I would ask you how to spell chihuahua. I doubt there's one in 100 of you who could spell it. I had to look it up in the dictionary myself. If you take a chihuahua and compare it with a Great Dane, you have an enormous difference. It seems to be an enormous difference. And so Darwin is saying, look, what man has been able to do by selective breeding in a very short space of time. Now, if we can do that in a very short space of time, just think what natural selection could do over a period of millions of years. It could turn a reptile into a mammal. Now, think carefully. The differences between a chihuahua and a Great Dane are of an altogether different nature to the differences between a reptile and a mammal. What's the difference between a chihuahua and a Great Dane? There's hardly any difference at all except for the shape, the size, the color, and the appearance. The bodily parts are exactly the same. But what's the difference between a mammal and a reptile? Well, the differences between mammals and reptiles are enormous. That's why one's called a mammal and one's called a reptile.
Let's start the time scales.
Yes. Okay. Can we have questions at the end?
Sure.
The difference between a reptile and a mammal are not differences of appearance or shape or size or color. They are fundamental and radical differences. For instance, if we were to try and change a mammal into a reptile, we need to evolve a fourth chamber in the heart. By mutation and natural selection only. We need to evolve mammary glands and a milk supply. We need to evolve a hair covering. We need to evolve a temperature control system for warm blood. We need to evolve a corti in the inner ear. We need to evolve a diaphragm. Now, this is just a very small sample. I could make a list of 100, maybe 500 things. All those things have got to take place to change one basic kind of animal, a mammal, or a reptile, into another basic kind of animal, a mammal. These are mammoth changes, and I would say this is a staggering claim. Dear old Carl Sagan, who was not on the same wavelength as me as far as belief in God is concerned, he was an atheist, he made this challenge. He said, extraordinary claims demand extraordinary proof. I'd like to just turn that back and apply it to the Darwinian theory. It is an extraordinary claim that every organ in your body, every animal, every plant, every fungus, came from a single replicating molecule in a warm pond billions of years ago by nothing more than mutation by chance acted upon and selected by nature. That is a staggering, extraordinary claim. Now, we're going to outline tonight's lecture. First of all, we're going to dismiss 14 usual proofs for that claim. Then we're going to discuss 8 problems with the claim. And then we're going to discover 3 pathways to a different way of looking at things. I went to school in Oxford. Now, 25 years ago, I sat in a biology class. Well, I might as well tell you where it was. It was Magdalen College School. I won't tell you the name of the biology teacher. I wouldn't be that cruel. I remember the day he came in and said, "Today we're going to discuss human evolution." And he started to outline proofs. One of the proofs he gave, so-called proofs, was the evolution of the giraffe's neck. He told me, and the rest of the class, that a giraffe years ago had a short neck, and as it stretched up to reach the leaves on the trees, the low ones had to reach up higher and higher, and then when its child was born, the baby giraffe had a slightly longer neck than the adult giraffe, and so on and so on and so on until we got the giraffe today. Now that was complete unscientific nonsense and hocus pocus. That isn't even Darwinism. That's what's called Lamarckism. There was a man in France years ago, amusingly called John the Baptist de Lamarck, and he believed that you could inherit characteristics which you acquire during your lifetime. You can't do that. If you cut off a rat's tail, its baby will still have a tail. You cut off 1 million generations of rat's tail, that poor critter, 1,000,001st one, will still have a tail, because genetics has destroyed that so-called proof. But in the public mind, that's the kind of thing people actually believe. People believe that a reptile flapped around and frayed its scales, and then the frayed scale turned into feathers. But even if you could fray part of your body, if you haven't got the genetics for that fraying, it won't be passed on to your children. Now let me take you to the British Natural History Museum, a very imposing building down there in Kensington in London. As you go round, you start finding these so-called proofs for evolution. Dog breeding is one of the first that you come across. As I've said, Darwin reasoned that dogs are amazingly varied, and if human beings can bring out all this variety in a short space of time, what could evolution do over millions of years? But let us think about it. What if we start with? Dogs. What have we got now? Dogs. No dog in the world is any less of a dog than any other dog. And it's a very poor example of natural selection, because dogs are being bred intelligently by human beings. It's not even an analogy with natural selections. In fact, there are limits to what can be done. You could never make a dog as big as an elephant or as small as a pea, because the genetics aren't able to stretch that far. And if we let all the dogs out into the wild again, all those breeds would disappear, go back to one basic kind. So the variations between the dogs tell us absolutely nothing about where the dogs came from in the first place, and they're not a proof of evolution. You keep going around the museum, you come across an exhibit to do with the finches in the Galapagos Islands. That's an actual photograph of what's in the museum. It's called a textbook example of evolution. Darwin went to the Galapagos Islands off the coast of Ecuador, noticed that on the different islands there were different kinds of finches. Some had long beaks, some had short beaks. I think he found about 13 different species of finches. And so what he said was, surely God didn't make all these 13 different kinds. These have come about by natural selection, by different environments, and given a long enough time, it wouldn't just be a variation between beaks. The finches would turn into different kinds of animals. But again, let's think about it. What did we start with? Finches. What do we end with? Finches. In fact, this has got nothing to do with mutations. This is just the variety that's already in the genomes of those finches. And they're acted upon by various things that go on in the Galapagos Islands. If they have a drought, some of the short-beaked finches die off, and so on and so forth. So the variations between the finches tell us nothing, not one thing, about where those finches came from in the first place. I remember also the day in my biology class when the teacher put up on the board a sequence of horses. They had a small one with 4 toes at the start, going up to our present-day horse at the end with just the 1 hoof. I didn't know at the time, because I was only 15, 16, that the whole thing was made up. In fact, there are 12 different family trees at least of these horses. Basically, out of the 250 horse types, they've arranged them in a sequence, ignoring the fact that the rib numbers are changing and the vertebrae numbers in the back are changing, just lining them up in relation to how many toes they have and how big they are. In fact, a biologist who is an evolutionist, Harry Butt Nielsen, said, "The family tree of the horse is beautiful and continuous only in the textbooks." So that's proof number four. What about proof number five? I love this one. This is the one that they were on about on the radio with me today on Radio Oxford. The peppered moths. During the Industrial Revolution in England, there was a shift in Manchester between light peppered moss and dark coloured peppered moss. Back before the Industrial Revolution, most of the moss had been a light colour. After the Industrial Revolution, they were mainly a dark colour. Nobody understood why this industrial melanism was taking place until the 1950s, when a man called Mr. Kettlewell came along, and he went out in the daytime and he let a bunch of moss go in the middle of the day. And he tested with mark and capture and select experiments, and he found out that the birds ate the light ones because they could see them better on the bark of the tree, because the lichen had gone and they were darker than they had been before the Industrial Revolution. And this was hailed as the greatest proof ever of natural selection. It turns out that the whole thing was staged. I wonder, could anybody put their hand up here if you've ever seen a moth resting on the bark of a tree trunk in the middle of a day? In fact, the experts who examine these things and look into them, a guy called Cyril Clark, he spent 25 years studying this. He only ever saw one moth in his whole 25 years of experience resting on a tree trunk in the middle of the day. They're night flyers. And what Kettlewell did was, he went out in the middle of the day and let them go, and in the middle of the day, moths just land on the first thing they can and sit there. And so he took staged photographs, and the whole experiment was flawed from the beginning. And anyway, what did we start with? Moths. What did we finish with? Moths. All we have is a population shift. And the population shift between light and dark moths tells us nothing about where those moths actually came from in the first place. Turns out Kettlewell's explanation was too simple. Other factors were involved in the distribution. There is an evolutionist in the University of Chicago called Jerry Coyne. He was very candid about this in Nature magazine in a book review. He said, quote, "From time to time, evolutionists re-examine a classic experimental study and find to their horror that it is flawed or downright wrong." He further said, "My own reaction," this is to the peppered moth fraud, "resembles the dismay attending my discovery at the age of six that it was my father and not Santa who brought the presents on Christmas Eve." Is the peppered moth story the extraordinary proof we need to convince us that you can get from a bacterium to Beethoven by nothing but chance mutations selected by nature? Of course it's not. None of the five proofs that we've looked at so far fit into that category. But while we're on flying things, let's move on to fruit flies. What is a fruit fly? Well, it's a fly that feeds on fruit. Tiny, tiny little creature. A very interesting creature in relation to mutation, because it has a reproductive cycle every 2 weeks. And a very simple genetic structure, only between 4 and 8 pairs of chromosomes. And what the evolutionists have done to try and prove their theory is they've taken a bunch of these fruit flies and subjected the poor critters to x-rays. And they've x-rayed them and zapped them and x-rayed them and zapped them, hoping to see what mutations can produce. They even managed to produce a second pair of wings on one of these poor creatures, which was absolutely catastrophic for the poor creature, because he couldn't fly at all. The little balancers that he normally uses for balancing turned into wings, got in the way. He couldn't mate, so it was no good for natural selection. And it was all artificially maintained. What do we start with? Fruit flies. What do we end with? Fruit flies. There's not one fruit fly in the world that's any less of a fruit fly than all the other fruit flies in the world. In fact, this was a wonderful experiment to disprove evolution. If evolution is saying that mutations selected by nature have produced everything that we see today, then if we could produce millions of mutations and actually select them ourselves, then we would be mimicking what evolution has done. But in trying to mimic it, they were completely unsuccessful. I've been recently going back through this book by Charles Darwin, The Descent of Man. In his original book, Origin of Species, he doesn't deal with the evolution of man. He felt that that would might prejudice people accepting his theories. But in this book, he goes into it in great detail. There's a chapter in here where he gives what he calls three great classes of facts to prove that we came from ape-like creatures. Those three great classes of facts were, number one, similar bodily structures. Secondly, similar embryonic development. And thirdly, vestigial organs, what he called rudiments. Now, mark this. This is what Darwin thought were three great classes of facts. Now, let's look at them one by one. The first one, homology. Homology is basically saying that when you find organs, bodily organs, which are similar in structure between animals and humans and so on, that proves they had a common ancestor. For example, from your shoulder down to the tip of your fingers, you can match bone for bone with a rat, a dog, a horse, a bat, a porpoise, a man. You can match it bone for bone. And so the evolutionist says, well, if evolution's true, that makes perfect sense because we all come from a common ancestor. But if creation's true, why would God have made everybody with the same structure? Well, that doesn't speak of a God who's very inventive, does it? And so Theodosius Dobzhansky made the famous statement, nothing in biology makes sense without evolution. So Darwin's claim is structural similarity proves common ancestry. Or does it? Let's think about this. Your arm and your leg are profoundly similar in structure. You can match the radius and the ulna with the tibia and the fibula. You can match the humerus with the femur. You can match your arm with your leg structurally. Where does evolution say our arm came from? Evolution says our arms evolved from the pectoral fins of the fish, a lobe fish like the coelacanth. Where does evolution say our legs came from? It says our legs came from the pelvic fins of the fish. You see the inconsistency there? Our arms and legs are similar, and yet they don't have common descent. So an evolutionist says a horse leg and a human leg are similar, so they came from a common ancestor. But it looks at a human arm and a human leg and says, no, they didn't have a common ancestor. Well, which is it? Do you see the inconsistency in the homology argument? In fact, since the coming into being of molecular biology, we find out that similar organs in different animals actually come by a different genetic pathway, which they wouldn't if they were evolved from a common ancestor. In fact, they come from different parts of the embryo. Is that the extraordinary proof we need to prove that a bacterium turned into Beethoven by chance mutations selected by nature? Certainly not. Well, let's move on to Darwin's second major fact. Similar embryonic development. Living at the same time as Darwin was a German by the name of Ernst Haeckel. A racist biologist from Germany. He drew diagrams to show that embryos from various classes of vertebrates were very, very similar. He omitted frogs and marsupials and others that were a bit too tricky to deal with. And he drew them all the same size, even though they're very different from, let's say, 1 millimeter to 10 millimeter. But he drew them, and there you see them on the screen. He's basically saying that humans and pigs and chickens and salamanders, in the embryo stage, they're all pretty much the same. They're almost exactly the same. And that just simply makes it absolutely obvious that we've all come the same way, we've all evolved the same way, and we all have a common ancestor. Darwin called it a marvellous fact. In fact, in this Descent of Man book, on page 42, he says, "The embryos of a man, a dog, a seal, a bat, and a reptile can at first be hardly distinguished from each other." And he goes on to say that because humans and other vertebrates pass through the same early stages of development, we ought to frankly admit their community of descent. In other words, Darwin is saying, those drawings by Haeckel show us absolutely clearly that we all come from a common ancestor. There's only one problem. The whole thing was a fake. Ernst Haeckel faked the drawings. The top line on your screen is Ernst Haeckel's fake drawings. The second line is a photograph of what they actually look like. Does a human and a rabbit and a chicken and a turtle and a salamander and a fish look similar at that stage? No, they look vastly different. So Darwin's great fact is actually a fiction. And yet, even though this is one of the most famous fakes in biological history, Darwin wrote a letter to his friend Asa Gray on September the 10th, 1860, in which he called embryology by far the strongest evidence in favour of his theory. Now, what are you going to do with that? The man who changed the way the world thinks about evolutionary origins and about biology rested as his strongest case on something that was a deliberate fraud. Now, let's move on to the third great fact of Darwin, vestigial organs. In his book, The Descent of Man, Darwin speaks about some organs of our body which are absolutely useless. Now, you're not talking about things you can do without. You can do without your little finger. You can do without your arm if you have to. That's not a vestigial organ. He's talking about things that are absolutely useless leftovers from evolution. He lists things like the appendix, chest hair, wisdom teeth, certain ear and scalp muscles, and one that I've got on your screen there, the coccyx. That's the lower end of your backbone. Is the coccyx a vestigial organ? No, it's not. The coccyx forms the point of insertion for the gluteus maximus, which is a muscle that runs down the back of your thigh. And it also is the point of insertion for ligaments, which are used during childbirth and when you go to the bathroom. If you had your coccyx removed, you would have to be retrained to use other muscles to enable you to go to the bathroom. That is not a vestigial organ. In fact, all those 100 so-called vestigial organs are now acknowledged by many scientists to be necessary and all part of the works. Well, you say, okay, well, Darwin got it a bit wrong, but, you know, Darwin did live a long time ago and he was very advanced for his time, but of course we've come a long way since then and we've now got genetics and molecular biology, so we don't really need those things, even if those things are wrong, we've got plenty of other proofs. I mean, for instance, look at bacteria, look at the way they can evolve to become resistant to antibiotics. Is that a good proof for evolution? Is that the extraordinary proof we're looking for? To prove that bacterium has changed into Beethoven by accidental mutations selected by... Is that the proof? Is this it? Have we finally got the proof? Because a bacterium is now resistant to antibiotics? Well, think about it. Take an antibiotic called streptomycin. That's what's been used for years against tuberculosis and typhoid and spinal meningitis and so on. Because it's been used very frequently and very widely, we're now in a situation where bacteria have evolved resistance to that antibiotic. Does that prove evolution? Well, it all depends how the bacterium evolves resistance to the antibiotic. Let me tell you what happens. Normally what happens is the streptomycin goes in to the bacterium and attaches itself to the ribosome. That then shuts down the protein sequencing in the bacterium and it can no longer reproduce and so it dies and you get better. But if there's a mutation in the ribosome, in the bacterium, a certain kind of mutation, which means that the antibiotic streptomycin can no longer attach to it, it survives. Does that prove that everything that we see today came by chance mutations from an original replicating molecule in a warm pond millions of years ago? Certainly not. Because what's happening is this. Resistance is gained, according to Dr. Lee Spetner, who's an expert in this, resistance is gained not by adding something, but by losing it. You see, to have evolution, you've got to have new, meaningful sequences of genetic information being added in. You've got to have a building up of specified complex information in the genome. What you're getting here is a loss of genetic information, not a gain. It'd be like when the police came in here tonight to arrest everybody and handcuff everybody. If I had no arms, I would have an advantage over you. They couldn't handcuff me. But I don't think that's very much of an advantage, do you? That's the kind of advantage that we're seeing here. Now then, let's go on to another molecular situation. A disease called sickle cell anemia. I've been to India a few times where this is a major problem. In your red blood cells, you have a protein called hemoglobin. A single mutation in that hemoglobin eventually changes your red blood cells from that lovely donut shape to that sickle shape. If you inherit this mutant protein from both of your parents, you'll probably die. If you inherit it from one parent, you become a character. You may have the symptoms if you climb a tall mountain, but other than that, you'll probably be all right. But there's one thing that an evolutionist points to here and says there's a byproduct from this. There's an advantage that's conferred upon someone who's got this. Does anybody know what it is? They can't get malaria. A byproduct of this disease is that you can't get malaria. Again, it's a loss of complexity, not a gain. I would liken it to, let's say you're working on Word on your PC. You're typing up a document with your word processing package, and there's a corruption gets into your word processing package. But the byproduct of that corruption is there's a certain type of email virus which will no longer attack your computer because you've got a little bit of corruption in your Word document. Aren't you glad you got that corruption in your Word document? Now you're safe from that email virus. You see, that's not building complex specified information. That is actually a mutation, a deleterious mutation, which doesn't prove evolution at all. So the hemoglobin mutation tells us nothing about where the hemoglobin came from in the first place. You say, well, what about molecular similarity? I remember when I went to the British Museum of Natural History, one of the first things I came across in the human evolution exhibit was a claim that chimpanzees and humans share 98% of the same DNA. And that sounds pretty convincing, doesn't it? You know, if they're that near to us, we must be related to them. Well, there are some anomalies with this whole idea of molecular similarity. First of all, according to Nature magazine, May 27th, 2004, it's not 98%, it's 92.3%. You say, oh, well, give or take a few percentage, who cares? Well, you obviously don't know much about genetics if you think you can throw away percentage points. 7.7% is a huge difference. Take, for example, a simple illustration. A cloud, a jellyfish, and a watermelon are all 98% water. Oh, and who cares? I mean, that means they're all the same, doesn't it? See, 2% can make a vast difference. But it's easy to take a very selective issue. What about other molecular issues? What if we take the number of chromosomes? Now, if evolution was true, you'd think that simple creatures like bacteria would have a very few chromosomes, and complicated creatures like ourselves would have the most. That's not the way it works. If you take fruit flies, you've got 4 pairs of chromosomes. Humans, 23 pairs. Gypsy moth, 31 pairs. Some types of chrysanthemums, 99 pairs. That renders badly for the theory of evolution. What about the amount of DNA? You know, you'd have thought we'd have had more than anybody else. That's not true. Some creatures have got more than us. What about the distance between proteins? You take the hemoglobin of a lamprey, a little jawless fish. You find out that it's equidistant from amphibians and birds and marsupials and humans. There's not a continuous stretching. It's equidistant, which it wouldn't be if evolution was true. Now let me go back for the last two to the Natural History Museum. There we have one of the most famous so-called proofs for evolution, that is Archaeopteryx. What is Archaeopteryx? It's a pigeon-sized extinct bird. Fossils of it have been found in Germany, and the discovery of it coming two years after Darwin's book, The Origin of Species, it seemed to be a gift, a powerful proof of Darwin's theory. You say, why was it a powerful proof of Darwin's theory? Well, it had feathers and a beak, perching feet and a wishbone, like a bird. But shockingly, it had teeth and claws and a long bony tail, like a reptile. So is it a bird or is it a reptile? Well, it was obviously a missing link between the two. And there we have it. This is the extraordinary proof we need to prove evolution. Well, let's just not get carried away. Let's take the issue of teeth. Some reptiles don't have teeth. Turtles don't have teeth. Several ancient birds that everybody agrees were birds do have teeth. So teeth are not the issue. Well, what about the claws? This bird had claws on its wings. I mean, birds just don't have claws on their wings. So it must have been a reptile. Well, again, don't get carried away. There's a bird in Africa called the turucu. It's born with claws on its wings. There's a bird in South America called the watsin. I've got a photograph of it here. It has claws on its wings. I've got a photograph of the claw. There you can see the claw. That is a close-up photograph of the claw on the watsin's wing. When it falls out of the nest, it can crawl back in. Later on in its existence, those claws disappear. So teeth don't prove it. Claws don't prove it. But let's just think about this. If we were going to prove evolution from reptiles to birds, what we would need would not be fully formed feathers. We would need partly formed feathers. Every single feature of the Archaeopteryx is a fully formed feature. In other words, it's not part way between two things. It is a mosaic of several features. Now that's seen elsewhere in nature. What about the duck-billed platypus? It has fur and suckles its young like a mammal, but it lays eggs like a reptile. It has webbed feet and a bill like a duck, and it has a poisonous spur on its rear leg like a snake's fang. It's a mosaic, and so was the Archaeopteryx a mosaic. And so the ardent evolutionist, Pierre Lecomte de Noailles, he said, "We are not even authorized to consider the exceptional case of the Archaeopteryx as a true link. An animal displaying characters belonging to two different groups cannot be treated as a true link as long as the intermediary stages have not been found and as long as the mechanisms of this transition remain unknown." Now let us move on because we've got a lot of ground still to cover. Let us go to proof number 14, ape man. This whole subject fascinates me. In the Natural History Museum, I took this photograph. Most of these photographs were taken with my own camera in the museum. There is a 4-foot-high chimpanzee-looking creature. The creature that you see on the right was built based upon the bones you see on the left. That's all they had to go on to build the creature on the right. This is an Australopithecine, a southern ape. This particular one, it was called Lucy because when it was found by Donald Johanson in 1974, the Beatles song Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds was playing on the radio, so they decided they'd call it Lucy. Now, I'm particularly interested in this one because I believe it is a complete fraud. If you look at Lucy, you'll see a sort of interesting, thoughtful look on her face. You'll see the completely human hands that she has. Now, notice they've given her completely human hands. But notice here, there are no bones for the human hands. They've given her, you can't see it so well on the screen, but that's completely human-looking feet, based on nothing. So they gave her completely human feet, completely human hands, without a bone to go on. I wrote a letter to the head of the department there in the Natural History Museum and question him about that, because to me that's a very misleading exhibit. If you, as you go round, you find other misleading looking photographs. This is another photograph from the Natural History Museum. Here they've drawn these creatures, half human, half chimpanzee. Reminded me very much of the picture that occurred. It was put into the London Illustrated News in 1922. Somebody was in Nebraska one day and they dug up this tooth. And Sir Grafton Elliot Smith, a distinguished English anatomist, he commissioned a painting which was given a 2-page spread in the London Illustrated News. You know, you can imagine him going to these people and saying, can you draw the creature that this tooth used to come from? And the man said, yeah, I'll draw his wife as well while I'm at it. And so he draws Mr. and Mrs. Nebraska Man. You know, they went back, I think it was 5 years later, was it? Yes, 5 years later, and they found the rest of the animal. Turned out it was an extinct pig. Well, it wasn't an ape, wasn't a man, it was an extinct pig. That's a case of a pig making a monkey out of an evolutionist. But let's go back to Lucy. What are the similar features between Lucy and man? Well, the shape of the jaw is somewhat similar. But that wouldn't be conclusive proof, because there's a wide range of shapes of jaws in humans and chimps. The size of the teeth was somewhat similar, but again, that wouldn't be conclusive, because there are various types of apes that have similar teeth to humans. The biggest play that they gave was on the femur. You'll notice the angle is coming in. Normally, an ape, their legs go straight down, and when they walk, they have to walk from side to side, otherwise they'd fall over. We don't have to do that because we've got an angle, about 9 degrees going in. So when I lift this foot up, I can still stand up because my centre of gravity is almost directly under my body. And so they said that Lucy had a 15-degree angle, and therefore she was on the way to walking on 2 feet. Well, there are several problems with that. Although gorillas and chimps have straight legs, orangutans and spider monkeys have very similar carrying angles to Lucy. And yet they just climb trees and they don't walk upright all the time. They can walk upright, but they are not bipedal in that sense. But let's go back to these hands. I wrote to, I'm just trying to find his name here. Here we are, Professor Chris Stringer. He's the head of human origins at the London History Museum. And I said, excuse me, how can you dare to put human hands and human feet on this creature when you don't have a bone to go on? And he wrote back and said, I wasn't here when Lucy was made. That was 25 years ago. Then he sent me along to look at some journals. It actually has turned out that there are several other Australopithecine skeletons throughout the world, and some of them do have hands and some of them do have feet, and they find out that they are long and curved, just like apes and gorillas would be expected to be. Their wrists are capable of locking, so they are knuckle walkers. They have different shaped ribs, a different shaped ridge cage, and their skulls are typically ape-like. Charles Oxnard, who Stephen Jay Gould called our leading expert on the qualitative study of skeletons, declared, the Australopithecines are now irrevocably removed from a place in the evolution of human bipedalism, and certainly from any place in the direct human lineage. You see, what about all the other ones? Well, before we get to all the other ones, let me just put up one more slide here. I read a book recently called The Origin of Man by Stuart Burgess. Very, very interesting book. He's the head of the Department of Mechanical Engineering at Bristol University. Very, very clever designer. And he goes through the differences between ape and man in relation to upright walking. And he says you need a lot more than just an angled femur to walk upright. In fact, he says there are 10 different features that you need for upright walking, including upright hip joints, a straight back, flat face, upright knee joints, long leg, arch feet, and so on and so forth. And he says in every one of these, Lucy completely fails. But you say, what about all the other ones? What about Homo erectus and Neanderthal man and Homo and Habilis and all the rest of them? What about them? Well, let's ask an expert. Let's ask the chief science writer of Nature magazine, Henry Gee. This is what he said in 1999. He said that the conventional picture of human evolution as lines of ancestry and descent is, quote, a completely human invention created after the fact and shaped to accord with human prejudices. In other words, when you see that row of nicely sequenced apes going up and finally reaching man, that's a fiction. He further stated, quote, to take a line of fossils and claim that they represent a lineage is not a scientific hypothesis that can be tested, but an assertion that carried the same validity as a bedtime story. Amusing, perhaps even instructive, but not scientific. I even read a shocking quote in the National Geographic, not known for its anti-evolutionary views. Just recently, July 12, 2001, the world of paleoanthropology, in other words, finding the origins of man, is highly contentious, and scientists have been trying for many decades to sort out the murky ancestry of today's human race by comparing thousands of fossil bones and skulls, but no evidence is certain and no lineages are clear. But you see, the average person in the street thinks it's all settled. But it's not. Behind closed doors, the theory is in crisis because the proofs don't stack up. Now, we started a little bit late, so I'm going to just hope you're going to give me a couple of minutes to go over time. It's no wonder that the Professor Simon Conway Morris, a paleontologist from Cambridge University, said, when discussing organic evolution, the only point of agreement seems to be, it happened. Thereafter, there is little consensus. So we've looked at the 14 so-called proofs. Now I want to look at eight problems. The first problem is the very nature of mutations themselves. Mutations cannot account for all of life because they are far too infrequent. They never result in a gain of genetic information. They are often balanced out in reproduction and they are almost always harmful. Hemophilia, sickle cell anemia, muscular dystrophy, cystic fibrosis, Down syndrome, 4,000 other diseases and illnesses are a result of mutation. It's not a world-building engine. It's a very destructive system. In fact, the genetic system's prime function seems to be to resist change. So mutations is a huge problem, not a plus. Plus, there are limits on mutations. Second problem is the limit. There was an evolutionist once called Richard Goldschmidt, an eminent geneticist. He bred gypsy moths for 20 years and a million generations. All he got was gypsy moths. Nothing more, nothing less. Famed American plant breeder Luther Burbank said he could breed a plum from half an inch to 2.5 inches long. But it was impossible genetically to go as small as a pea or as big as a grapefruit. In other words, there are limits to what you can do with mutations. Professor Lane Lester and Raymond Bolin in their book, Natural Limits to Biological Change, said this, quote, natural selection, recombination, mutation and speciation can all interact in concert to bring about startling variation, but there are limits to biological change. There are certain walls that mutations cannot jump. Natural selection also has limits. What can natural selection explain? It can explain a lot of things. It can explain different beak sizes. It can explain wingless insects, sightless fish, flightless birds. But it cannot build complex structures in the first place. It can hone existing structures, but it cannot build complex structures. Then we have another problem with evolution. We have something called the Cambrian explosion. You say, what's that? Well, there is a layer of rock, very deep, which we call the Cambrian rock layer. Apparently the oldest rocks in existence. There may be some Precambrian ones slightly older, but for all intents and purposes, we're talking about the oldest rocks. Supposedly 540 million years old. But the fact is that in those rocks, you get the sudden appearance of between 25 and 35 completely novel body plans. They literally, on an evolutionary scale, just popped into existence. There they all are. with no ancestors. In fact, evolutionary paleontologist Peter Ward said, if ever there was evidence suggesting divine creation, surely the Precambrian and Cambrian transition, known from numerous localities across the face of the earth, is it. Another problem with evolution is a lack of transitional fossils. To be a Darwinian, you actually have to believe that the fossil record is completely misleading. It's like looking for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, looking for these missing transitional fossils. Darwin actually said in his book, Origin of Species, and I quote, "Why, then, is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? Geology does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain, and this perhaps is the most obvious and gravest objection which can be urged against my theory." Colin Patterson, the senior paleontologist at the British Museum of Natural History, he wrote in his book, he says here, "I will lay it on the line, there is not one such fossil for which one can make a watertight argument for being transitional." Stephen Gould, leading fossil expert, now dead, he says the extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontology. The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data at the tips and the nose of their branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of the fossils. And we say, well, you know, the problem is we just don't have a complete record. You know, we'll find them one day. It's just that, you know, the fossil record is incomplete. By what peculiar rules of probability does it happen that all the fossils we have found are the fully formed ones, and all the fossils we haven't found are the intermediate ones? We're nearly finished. Sixth problem with Darwinism, complex beginnings. If we go back to this Cambrian rock, you can find a little creature in there called a trilobite. It has been extinct for millions of years, so they say, and existed 570 million years ago. And yet, according to Lisa Scheuer, writing in Science News, the trilobites had, quote, "the most sophisticated eye lenses ever produced by nature." Now, this creature here that we're looking at, these trilobites, they had more complicated eye lenses than you have. And yet they're right there, smack bang at the beginning, 570 million years ago. Where did that complexity come from? Why didn't they have a simple eye? Why did they have a complex lens? That cannot be answered by Darwinian evolution. Seventh problem, irreducibly complex organs. An irreducibly complex organ it can be illustrated with a mousetrap. Just five parts to a mousetrap. If you take away any part, the mousetrap won't work. It won't half work. It won't a quarter work. It won't work at all. Take away any part of the mousetrap and it won't work at all. Now you bring that into the biological realm. Take the flagellum on the back of a bacterium. Basically, nanotechnology, the most sophisticated machine known in the universe, and there it is. Take away any of the proteins that run it, it won't work at all. So if you've got an organ that is irreducibly complex, it cannot be built by slow, gradual processes over millions of years. And finally, mathematics. I would love to have a pound for every time someone has said to me, "Oh yes, it can be done. All you need to do is put a bunch of monkeys in a room with a bunch of typewriters and give them millions of years and they'll produce the works of Shakespeare." And it's the same with mutations. Millions of years, plenty of time, we'll get everything we need. People are not thinking straight. Let me tell you the facts. I want you to think of a 12-letter word. Construction. Unreasonable. Do you know, a 12-letter word is so rare that they occur only once, by chance, in strings of letters 100 quadrillion letters long. If a monkey sits at a typewriter and starts typing at random, he will only get a 12-letter word that makes sense every 100 quadrillion letters. Now, if he types at one letter a second, it will take him 3 million years. It'll take a monkey 3 million years to get one meaningful 12-letter word. And you're trying to tell me you can get the whole works of Shakespeare? See, people don't actually test the theory. When they test the theory, it doesn't work. There isn't enough time in the whole history of an evolutionary universe to build one single protein 30 amino acids long. Not enough time. It cannot be done, not even on a supercomputer. Now, normally this lecture is done with the other two lectures in one day or over three nights. So I finish on a completely negative note and then we move on to the next one. But there may be folks here who won't come next week or won't come the week after. So I just want to finish and tie in three things before we go. We've looked at 14 proofs for evolution and we've dismissed them. We've looked at 8 problems with evolution. Now I want to look at 3 pathways that lead in a different direction. Pathways that lead to a creator. I mentioned on the radio this afternoon the issue of information. There are people looking for intelligence in outer space. The SETI program, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. What are they looking for? They're looking for information. They just don't want noise. If they could just get one intelligent radio signal from outer space, what would they conclude? That there's an intelligent being sent it. All they need is one intelligent radio signal to prove there's intelligence out there. Now take that down to a molecular level. If you look at your DNA, you are looking at complex, specified information. There's as much information in the DNA of one of your cells as there is in the entire Encyclopedia Britannica in print, and every letter has to be in the right place. Now that proves there is an intelligent creator. So information is a pathway that leads us to the conclusion that there is a creator. But not only information, but elimination. There are only 4 possibilities for where we all came from. We either came from nothing accidentally, we came from nothing supernaturally, we've always been here, or we're not really here at all, we're just an illusion. You can eliminate, I hope nobody here believes that we're just an illusion, nearly all of science, both creation and evolution, rejects the fact that we've always been here. Did we come from nothing accidentally, or did we come from nothing supernaturally? You can't come from nothing accidentally. There is only one option. We must have come from nothing supernaturally. So you can reach to a creator, not only by information, but by elimination. But finally, you can reach to a creator by revelation. Now, revelation is rejected by evolutionary science, but on the third lecture, if you're able to come, I will give you enough proof to send you home with a head full that in the Bible, there is clear evidence that God has spoken. Many, many evidences, in particular, the predictive accuracy of Scripture. Prophecies in the Old Testament that were fulfilled in the New. You say, well, look, if all is as you say, if evolution is a load of rubbish, and if creation is so easy to find, and God is so easy to discover through information and elimination and revelation, why doesn't everybody believe it? I've often thought about that. Partly ignorance, they're not exposed to the facts. Partly they don't want to believe it. Richard Dawkins said, quote, "I am a Darwinist because I believe the only alternatives are Lamarckism or God, neither of which does the job as an explanatory principle." Professor Watson said the same thing. Evolution is a theory universally accepted, not because it can be proven by logically coherent evidence to be true, but because the only alternative, special creation, is clearly incredible. I wonder, is there somebody in the room tonight? And if the truth was told, the real reason you believe in evolution isn't because of the facts. You have an emotional attachment to it because you don't want to admit there's a God. Perhaps you were forced to go to church three times a week when you were a child and you just got enough of it and you don't want anything to do with that anymore. And even though you can't really prove it, you're willing to accept evolution because the alternative gives you a shudder. You're making an unwise choice. Finally, some people actually admit it. And this is my last point. Then you can all have a cup of tea. Distinguished Harvard geneticist Richard Lewontin said this. This is one of the most staggering quotes you will ever hear. This is why this guy believes in evolution. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs. In spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life. In spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories. Because we have a prior commitment. A commitment to materialism. It's not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation for the phenomenal world. But on the contrary, that we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations. No matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated, moreover, that materialism is an absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. A leading scientist in Harvard University. If you know how Harvard University was founded, that's a very sad quotation to read. So, the lecture is finished. Next week, we're going to look at not the scientific bankruptcy of Darwinian evolution, but the philosophical bankruptcy of Darwinian evolution.